to better use, Democratic members of Congress and other observers immediately accused the Treasury Secretary of a potentially unlawful ploy to hamstring the Biden administration's coronavirus response before the president-elect takes office. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Mnuchin violates CARES Act with plan to move $455 billion in unspent COVID funds. Here's the details of this article. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is under fire for attempting to undermine the incoming U.S. administration's response to the COVID-19 pandemic on his way out the door after his department confirmed recently that it intends to place $455 billion in unspent coronavirus relief funds into an account that requires congressional authorization to access. Bloomberg reported that the funds, which Congress allocated to the Federal Reserve in March for emergency lending programs to assist local governments and struggling businesses, will be put in the Treasury Department's general fund following Mnuchin's widely condemned decision last week to cut off the relief programs at the end of the year. Mnuchin requested that the funds be reallocated by the currently divided Congress, and the Fed has agreed to cooperate with the outgoing Treasury Secretary's move. According to Bloomberg, Mnuchin's clawback would make it impossible for Janet Yellen, President-elect Joe Biden's pick to lead the Treasury Department, to utilize the funds without lawmakers' blessing. The move leaves just under $80 billion available in the Treasury's Exchange Stabilization Fund, a pot of money that can be used with some discretion by the Treasury chief, Bloomberg noted. By contrast, the CARES Act funds had specific uses and weren't available for general government spending purposes. Why Mnuchin, a former Goldman Sachs banker, insisted he is attempting to ensure the funds are put to better use, Democratic members of Congress and other observers immediately accused the Treasury Secretary of a potentially unlawful ploy to hamstring the incoming U.S. administration coronavirus response before the president-elect takes office. According to one analyst, Mnuchin's actions are an explicit violation of the CARES Act. This is Treasury's latest ham-handed effort to undermine the new U.S. administration. The good news is that it's illegal and it can be reversed next year, tweeted Bharat Ramamurthy, a member of the Congressional Commission established to oversee the use of coronavirus relief money. For its part, the Fed should not go along with its attempt sabotage and should retain the CARES Act funds it already has. Senator Ron Wyden, the top Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee, denounced as shameful Mnuchin's effort to pull back the congressional relief funds and place them out of the Biden administration's reach. As the economy backslides amid skyrocketing COVID-19 cases, Secretary Mnuchin is engaged in economic sabotage and trying to tie the Biden administration's hands, Wyden said in a statement to Reuters recently. Echoing Wyden, Senator Elizabeth Warren tweeted on November 24th that Secretary Mnuchin's COVID-19 response has been a corrupt and incompetent failure. He needs to stop sabotaging the new administration from cleaning up his mess and helping states, cities, and small businesses, said Warren. According According to reports, many of the U.S. health insurance coverage advances that occurred after the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010 were rolled back by a relentless Trump administration campaign to sabotage the ACA. In 2016, according to Kaiser Family Foundation estimates, 26.7 million Americans were uninsured. By the end of 2019, that number had grown to 29.2 million. This was still far lower than 46.8 million uninsured at the time of the ACA's passage. But the warning signs are clearly there. There has been a recent acceleration in the number of uninsured. In fact, several think tanks and healthcare advocacy groups have estimated that the longer the pandemic lasts, the more American families will lose their health insurance. The estimates range from a low nearly 3 million workers losing insurance as they lose their jobs to a high of 8.5 million people ending up uninsured. Making this health situation even more precarious, groups monitoring hunger and food insecurity in the United States of America have reported extreme spikes in the numbers of Americans who struggle to put enough food on the table. Earlier this year, that number was thought to be about 37 million. Today, it is 54 million, or 1 in 6 Americans. 17 million of these are children. Food banks around the U.S. are reporting unprecedented demand. But the crisis goes far beyond these statistics. Precarious access to housing, medical care, and food is magnified by structural crises in the environments that poor Americans live in.
As the people and officials of Iran turned out to pay their respects to the assassinated nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the evidence surrounding the murder began to come to light as more and more clues began to emerge about the circumstances that led up to the killing. Various voices have sent messages of condolences to Iran, as well as to the family and friends of Fakhrizadeh, coupled with strong words of condemnation over the assassination by the likes of the European Union, Hamas, Hezbollah, as well as countries like the United Arab Emirates, China, Jordan, and the UK. Yet again, in circumstances similar to the assassination of Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary or Arbitrary Executions has stated that the assassination of Fakhrizadeh constituted as an extrajudicial killing, suggesting foul play was at the heart of the act. It seems that further evidence has emerged that following the information revealed to Press TV, indications are pointing towards equipment being used in the attack originating from the Israeli regime's arsenal, with senior Iranian officials also stating that the technology used to commit the act was complicated and used remote devices, raising the question as to why the global arena is not calling for this crime to be investigated.
Israelis, they have the capacity and expertise in this. They have done it before. They have assassinated, with the help of the United States, some other Iranian scientists. And they have the motivation. They can gain from this assassination. So there are many reasons to say that Israelis, maybe with the help of Americans, they have done it. Whether other countries, including some of their Arab allies, are also involved in this or not, that's the question. And I think after the investigation and official conclusion, we might be hearing about this from Iranian officials. And according to that conclusion, I think we might be seeing a reaction from Iranian side.
As usual, the Israeli regime has remained eerily silent over the assassination, suggesting by the silence that they have too much to hide, which is not uncommon, as the regime have remained coy on numerous occasions in the past when it comes to the assassination of targets by the Zionist regime. Yet even if the Israelis are not responsible for pulling the trigger, The apparent use of satellite technology to activate the devices used clearly shows some notion of state-sponsored activity and likely sees the Israeli regime's criminal counterparts from the MEK also play a part in the logistics and execution of the act in Iran, something that again bears all the common denominators of a Zionist plot. Tension appears to have risen in the recent weeks following the US elections, especially in parts of West Asia, where traditional allies to the US have started to express concerns that they'll not receive preferential treatment during the next US government's term in office. The emerging evidence that shows the weaponry used in the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh had the hallmarks of Israeli origin suggests that the murder was not solely aimed at stopping the Islamic Republic of Iran pursuing its legitimate and peaceful civilian nuclear program, but was really an act of extreme provocation. A recent meeting in the Saudi region of Neom between Mike Pompeo, Benjamin Netanyahu and Mohammed bin Salman, which has been denied by some, suggests that the planned assassination of Fakhrizadeh was discussed at the meeting, putting the three states on high alert prior to the action. With all three regimes opposed to the Islamic Republic of Iran, the notion of no smoke without fire has never been truer when it comes to this sensitive issue. Was it then the Israeli regime that masterminded the assassination, gaining a nod from its friends along the way? Iran's reaction has been one vowing revenge for the assassination of the esteemed nuclear scientist. Yet, revenge for Iran does not necessarily mean in a like-for-like form of self-defense. For Iran, the most powerful form of revenge could come in the form of a diplomatic card, with the Iranian president Hassan Rouhani, for one, stating that Iran is far too wise to fall into the trap set by the Zionist regime to provoke Iran into starting a conflict.
I think Iran is in a situation whereby assumes any reaction or response to this assassination inevitable, because if it doesn't respond, it will make the other side to advance further, and that will encourage them to do further assassinations or actions against Iran. But any serious response also might have a risk of, let's say, chain of actions or reaction which might end in a conflict in the region.
With diplomacy on the table, the most painful strike to the murderous Zionist regime would be showing the world that as a peace-loving nation, the pen is mightier than the sword.
European countries have announced varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. The prolonged lockdown measures, as well as uncertainty over how long they can last, has led to anger and frustration among European citizens. In the UK, anti-lockdown protesters held a rally in central London on Saturday, chanting freedom and causing traffic disruption. Clashes erupted between the Metropolitan Police and the protesters, who were not wearing masks nor social distancing. Over 150 arrests were made. It was unclear how many protesters participated in the rally, but similar demonstrations in the country have drawn tens of thousands of people to the streets. Other protests this month have been forcibly broken up by police, who arrested 190 people at once on November 5th when the country's second national lockdown went into force.
Well, there has been a great deal of hardship caused by this. I mean, many businesses have gone bankrupt or are in, you know, about to go bankrupt, and many people have lost their jobs. People have been unable to attend the funerals of friends and relatives. Many weddings have been cancelled, or when they go ahead, only a few people can attend. And here in Britain, at least, people will have some normality at Christmas and be able to visit their relatives to a certain extent. But yes, it's been very difficult, very hard on people.
Also on Saturday, several hundred people, mostly not wearing face masks, descended on the German border town of Frankfurt an der Oder to protest the lockdown measures. Among the protesters were people from the adjacent Polish town of Słubice. The rally was organized by the Quendercare movement that opposes the German government's measures to stem the spread of the novel coronavirus. European countries have announced varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. The prolonged lockdown measures, as well as uncertainty over how long they can last, has led to anger and frustration among European citizens. In the UK, anti-lockdown protesters held a rally in central London on Saturday, chanting freedom and causing traffic disruption. Clashes erupted between the Metropolitan Police and the protesters, who were not wearing masks nor social distancing. Over 150 arrests were made. It was unclear how many protesters participated in the rally, but similar demonstrations in the country have drawn tens of thousands of people to the streets. Other protests this month have been forcibly broken up by police, who arrested 190 people at once on November 5th when the country's second national lockdown went into force.
Well, there has been a great deal of hardship caused by this. I mean, many businesses have gone bankrupt or are in, you know, about to go bankrupt, and many people have lost their jobs. People have been unable to attend the funerals of friends and relatives. Many weddings have been cancelled, or when they go ahead, only a few people can attend. Here in Britain, at least, people will have some normality at Christmas and be able to visit their relatives to a certain extent. But yes, it's been very difficult, very hard on people.
Also on Saturday, several hundred people, mostly not wearing face masks, descended on the German border town of Frankfurt an der Oder to protest the lockdown measures. Among the protesters were people from the adjacent Polish town of Słubice. The rally was organized by the Quendercker movement that opposes the German government's measures to stem the spread of the novel coronavirus.
Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a leading nuclear scientist, was assassinated in a terrorist attack on Friday. Iran's defense ministry said the top scientist was seriously wounded after attackers targeted his car and exchanged fire with his bodyguards in the town of Absart to the east of capital Tehran. Fakhrizadeh later died from his injuries in hospital. Fakhrizadeh was Iran's most renowned nuclear scientist, who headed the Ministry of Defense's Research and Innovation Organization. His assassination prompted outrage in the country, with officials blaming Israel for the terrorist attacks and pledging retaliation. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, called for those involved in the assassination of Fakhrizadeh to be brought to justice.
It is evident terrorism has targeted the scientific progress of the Islamic world in general, and the Islamic Republic in particular. The first and foremost reason for this hostility is our development, is our progress, is our self-sufficiency, is the strength of our fists at this very moment as we shout out loud what is just and inflict upon it the truth.
And Iranian President Hassan Rouhani called Fakhrizadeh's assassination a proof of enemy's desperation.
This terrorist act indicates the enemy's failures in political fronts in the region as well as across the world. The assassination of the scientist suggests the extent of enemy's malice and garage toward Iran's scientific capabilities and achievements. The killing of figures like Fakhrizadeh will not weaken Iran's will to move toward scientific development and progress. Rather, it makes Iranians more resolute in their path.
Fakhrizadeh's name was specifically mentioned in Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's presentation about Iran's nuclear program in April 2018. At the time, Netanyahu said he identified Fakhrizadeh as the head scientist in the program and urged people to remember that name.
A key part of the plan was to form new organizations to continue the work. This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said there are, quote, serious indications of an Israeli role in the assassination. He urged the international community, especially the European Union, to end, quote, their shameful double standards and condemn the assassination of the nuclear scientist. Zarif was referring to a trial in Belgium where four Iranian diplomats were accused of plotting a bomb attack in Paris. One of the latest projects that Fakhrizadeh was involved in was the development of the first indigenous COVID-19 test kit. U.S. sanctions prevent Iran from accessing medicine and humanitarian goods during this pandemic. The top scientist was also supervising the development of a COVID-19 vaccine. Four other Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated between 2010 and 2012, with Tehran and Western intelligence agencies blaming Israel for those killings. The Israeli terror campaign has been widely seen as a project to stymie Iran's peaceful nuclear activities, which have been under intense scrutiny of the United Nations Nuclear Agency.
Zionism, imperialism, the whole Western blood-soaked empires that assassinate, that murder, bomb, and displace, and then justify their crimes through propaganda, just like they did throughout the colonization epoch, where what I believe is that wherever in the world there is oppression, there will be a struggle. And wherever in the world there is a struggle, we shall be there. And if they think that they are threatened, well, because they are the oppressors.
This assassination follows a not-so-secret meeting in Saudi Arabia between the Saudi foreign minister and Israeli prime minister last week. It sent another signal that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and Benjamin Netanyahu see this window as their last best chance in a while to try to inflict a crippling blow on Iran. Experts believe Riyadh and Tel Aviv are seeking to complicate an already challenging course for a new U.S. team to re-engage with Iran. The U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the 2015 Iran deal in 2018. Since then, Washington carried out what it called a maximum pressure campaign against Iran and imposed massive sanctions against the country. But future President of the United States, Joe Biden, has pledged to re-engage with Iran when he becomes U.S. President in January, despite long-standing opposition from Israel.
Up until now, the EU have played the winning hand on every account as they face off with the British over a post-Brexit trade deal. Yet as the deadline fast approaches for the British to beg the EU to adhere to some kind of trade rules, desperate measures may be taken in the 11th hour of the negotiations. With many of the big players in the EU very much in favour of the bloc, the French have urged the EU chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, to remain firm and stick to the plan, compelling him to stay tough on the approach the EU takes with the British. The Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, recently stated that any deal is now down to the friends and partners of the EU. Yet the message Boris Johnson must understand is that the very best deal he can expect to get would still have to be less favourable than the worst conditions of staying in the EU. Otherwise, what's the point of having an EU? So is this the future that Britain truly wishes to pursue? However, it seems that the EU is fast running out of patience with the British, with Barnier almost calling it a day recently, stating that there was no point negotiating over a lost cause, as it was clear that Britain was in no mood to make any commissions with the EU. Yet it seems that the EU lead has been reassured between the lines by the British chief negotiator, David Frost, that Britain may have no choice but to align to EU requests, much to the distaste of the British. So was the real reason that the EU agreed to more talks is because the British have finally realised that they must secure some kind of deal or face the perils of being a lonely piece of land floating off the coast of Europe with no friends, a shattered economy, and left in a position facing the realisation that the notion of stronger together was coined for the EU for a real good reason. When Dominic Cummings left Downing Street with his tail between his legs, there was an air of celebration in the UK as many people finally saw the back of a man who masterminded Brexit, yet on the other hand, breached the travel rules during the lockdown, making him public enemy number one. Yet with Cummings now gone, could this be an excuse for Boris Johnson to change his stance when it comes to negotiating with Europe, using Cummings as a scapegoat along the way for all the previous failures and weak negotiating skills against the EU, and leading Britain from his armchair in self-isolation. But the question is just how much Boris Johnson is being kept in the loop when it comes to the final rounds of talks, in particular as he is in isolation. Does the Prime Minister have the influence he may have had in person while sat at home? With the British now in a weaker-than-ever position since the apparent news that Joe Biden will become the next President of the United States, in particular when it comes to the handling of the situation in the north of Ireland, it seems that even as the talks near their final stages, the British are no closer to being able to come away from the talks with any hope of relying on a transatlantic trade deal, as Biden, as we all know, is a very different man from Trump. With the UK facing a very bleak Christmas and New Year due to the ongoing COVID-19 virus, as well as the notion that it may very well find itself without any trade partners come 2021, it seems that all measures must now be taken to somehow agree terms with the EU, and from there, somehow convincing the rest of the world that Little Britain is worth trading with, over and as opposed to trading with the might of the European Union.
Arabi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Arabi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Arabi English Radio.
In the limelight.
U.S. hospitals are facing rising pressure from a surge of coronavirus cases that is threatening to overwhelm their capacity as the country braces for further escalation following Thanksgiving. Over 93,000 people are in the hospital with coronavirus, a record level, and the number is only continuing to rise, according to data from the COVID Tracking Project. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Peter Sullivan Ryder. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Hospitals Brace for COVID-19 Surge. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. U.S. hospitals are facing rising pressure from a surge of coronavirus cases that is threatening to overwhelm their capacity as the U.S. braces for further escalation following Thanksgiving. Over 93,000 people are in the hospital with coronavirus, a record level, and the number is only continuing to rise, according to data from COVID Tracking Project. The U.S. is also recording more than 150,000 new cases every day, and the numbers are likely to only get worse given a burst of gatherings and travel from Thanksgiving. Hospitals around the country are steeling themselves for an already strained situation to get even worse. The Association of American Medical Colleges, AAMC, which represents academic medical centers across the U.S., sent a document to its member hospitals last week reminding them of crisis standards of care, which are used to cope with an overwhelming number of patients. "From everywhere, I'm hearing an increasing growing concern," said Janice Orlovsky, AAMC's chief medical officer. "I expect we are going to have another significant surge in numbers, and this is on top of what is already an extraordinary number of hospitalizations." Orlovsky said she expects more hospitals will soon have to start implementing crisis standards, which include stretching resources in ways that would not be done in normal times. For example, a nurse could be caring for four patients at once instead of two, she said. It's not a complete drop-off lake. You get care and you don't, she said. Instead of getting 100% of care, you might get 90% or 80%. Hospitals are already taking extraordinary measures. As part of a two-week pause announced by the governor, Rhode Island sent an alert to residents' cell phones recently, reading, "Hospitals at capacity due to COVID. Help the front line by staying home as much as possible for the next 2 weeks. A field hospital is opening in the state this week as well," it added. Jeff Potoff, Chief Quality Officer at the UW Health Hospital System in Madison, Wisconsin, said recently that his hospital is already past normal capacity. He said it is possible the hospital could get so overwhelmed that doctors are unable to care for people with heart attacks and strokes if there is another major surge following Thanksgiving. If we see another surge on top of the surge just we had, that gets pretty dicey for us, he said. We don't have too many more tricks up our sleeve. To provide more space for COVID-19 patients, the UC Health Hospital System in Cincinnati on Monday, November 30, converted its cardiovascular recovery unit into surge ICU capacity. The COVID surge here and across the U.S. is requiring this finite group of doctors and nurses to work more under intensely emotionally and physically draining conditions every day, and we are burning them out, said Amanda Neglison, spokeswoman for UC Health. Our healthcare workers can't continue at this pace, and there is only so many of them to deal with this surge, she added. The University of Utah's hospital has two extra teams taking care of COVID-19 patients in the ICU. Everyone that you talk to is tired, particularly in the critical care units where it's just grinding, said Russell Vinnick, the university's chief medical operations officer. Health officials are urging the public to take precautions like wearing masks, maintaining distance from others, avoiding indoor gatherings, and washing hands in order to lessen the burden on healthcare workers. Indoor social gathering is not something that should occur right now, said Orlovsky of AAMC. It should be extremely limited. Experts have also long warned that indoor dining should be closed in hard-hit areas. Still, only 15 states of the United States of America have closed their restaurants, according to a tracker from the Kaiser Family Foundation. Further economic assistance that could cushion the blow of business closures have been stalled in Congress for months. Close the restaurants and keep the schools open is what we really say, Anthony Fauci, the government's top infectious disease expert, said on Sunday, November 29th on ABC. Fauci said on NBC Meet the Press that he has been getting calls from colleagues in different states saying, "We are at that point where we soon, if things don't turn around quickly, we're going to have a situation with capacity, not only of hospital capacity but staff. You know, what do you think we should do?" Maryland Governor Larry Hogan tweeted a warning on Monday, November 30, that his state has its highest level of COVID-19 hospitalizations since May. As this new surge continues, each and every Marylander must exercise personal responsibility in order to save lives and prevent hospitals from overflowing, Hogan wrote. California Governor Gavin Newsom tweeted that hospitals there are on pace to run out of ICU beds before Christmas. Please stay safe and stay home as much as you can for next few weeks, he wrote. Orlovsky said there are now increasing problems in the United States of America with shortages of N95 masks and gloves for health workers, which she called a canary in the coal mine, for further shortages of protective equipment as cases and hospitalizations mount further across this country. There is some sliver of good news in that hospitalizations have started to dip slightly in recent days in some of the hardest hit states, including North and South Dakota and Wisconsin. But Orlovsky said she is worried that measure of improvement could soon be canceled out in those states by a new surge coming from Thanksgiving gatherings. A brighter light at the end of the tunnel comes from the promising news about both vaccines in different companies being highly effective. Those vaccines could start being administered to high-risk groups as soon as December, but it will be several months before they are widely available to the general public, meaning the crisis will not be abating in short term. Still, initial vaccinations of healthcare workers starting in December would be helpful in maintaining hospital capacity by preventing doctors and nurses from having to stay home with the virus. You are burning at both ends, said Vinick, the University of Utah doctor. If we can at least get our frontline COVID workers vaccinated, the candle will only burn at one end.
European News Bulletin.
Hello, everyone. I'm Saeed Pourreza, your host this hour. Our top story. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has warned of a psychological war with a targeted misinformation campaign following the assassination of the country's top nuclear scientist last week. A review of thousands of tweets published following the terror attack has shown that 79% were aimed at spreading disinformation and opposition to a nuclear deal with global powers. The tweets call for all negotiations to end and all IAEA inspectors to be removed from the country. However, an analysis of the accounts revealed 93% of the tweets were sent through unknown accounts set up less than a year ago and operating from outside Iran. According to Zarif, Israel is trying to capitalize on the final days of the Trump presidency, doing all they can to prevent President-elect Joe Biden's administration from lifting sanctions and resuming negotiations with Iran. Several Iranian MPs have signed a statement calling for IAEA inspectors to be expelled as a proportionate and immediate response. Iran's envoy to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, has called on the agency to unequivocally condemn the assassination. So far, UN agencies, the EU, and other Western powers have failed to condemn the killing and have instead called on all sides for calm. Mohsen Abbas is a political commentator joining me now for more on that story. Good to see you, Mohsen. So, an online campaign to use and manipulate last week's assassination. What do you make of it?
Well, it's an absolutely open secret, not a secret at all, that the Israelis have a huge investment, vast investment in cyber warfare capabilities. We know that they carried those out, of course, 10 years ago. The Stuxnet computer virus targeted Iran's nuclear program at that time. It's a peaceful nuclear program, I have to add. And that essentially was the first digital weapon that had been used in that kind of way. And subsequently, we've seen the attacks on the Natanz set up in Iran. We've witnessed this attack through the Bandar Abbas, the port, I think it's called the Shahid Rajai port in Bandar Abbas. Mm-hmm. That was also acknowledged by the Islamic Republic of Iran that a cyber attack had occurred. All of these are evidence of Israel's huge capacity for psychological warfare, cyber warfare, for using algorithms to, if you like, engineer not only attacks on other nations, but also to engineer color revolution, to try to make political viewpoints in a particular region act in their way. We know they've tried it in Iran, in Iraq. It's still ongoing. They organize this on a regular basis. So what Jawad Zarif is saying is not outside the realms of possibility, and I think very, very likely, yes.
All right. And given everything that has happened, they have killed Iranian nuclear scientists before, sabotaging Iran's peaceful nuclear program. There are people inside Iran saying, you know what, we have had enough of this. Let's break away free of nuclear treaties altogether. A lot of frustration. Is that the right course of action? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you can understand that frustration, because what was promised as part of the JCPOA was a loosening of the economic terrorism, the stranglehold. That's got worse since this whole process, if you like, has begun. They were promised a rapprochement in terms of many other areas of trade and general relations with Iran, none of which has been delivered either by the various European members or were signatories to JCPOA, let alone the Americans who walked out unilaterally. So you would not blame people in the Islamic Republic of Iran to be skeptical. I mean, we've had Trump killing one of the most, beloved servants of Iran, General Soleimani. We've had them now killing a nuclear scientist. I mean, let's throw it back on the Israelis, who have, let's not forget, a nuclear arsenal of 400 plus. Let's not forget that they have no IAEA inspections or scrutiny. Let's not forget that the Israelis have no accountability, no acting against the non-proliferation treaty. They're not signed up to that. So if their professors, for instance, Professor Israel Dostrovsky or Shaul Horer, some of the historic, if you like, counterparts of Mohsin Fakhrizadeh, if they were, if you like, attacked or killed or done away with, what would Israel do? Would they respond in a peaceful manner? I think Iran quite clearly is well within its rights to do whatever it wants. But revenge is often a dish best served cold. And I believe the Islamic Republic of Iran's leadership is wise enough to know when and where Israel will receive its response.
And Mohsin, very briefly, the silence on the part of the international community. You mentioned the Europeans that haven't delivered on their promises under the JCPOA, and no unequivocal condemnation of a blatantly terrorist attack.
Absolutely. The hypocrisy stinks, quite frankly. When the alleged Skripal affair took place and Russian double agents were supposed to have been attempted to have been killed by Russian spy agencies, according to MI5 and various others, there was never-ending, vitriol against the Russians of all kinds. In fact, 153 Russian diplomats were expelled during that period. They've done it again with one of the Russian, dissidents who's ended up in Poland only recently. So it's double standards. We know that. And they haven't condemned this in unequivocal terms. They're, of course, going to rely on Israel's plausible deniability strategies. So they won't openly admit that they've done it. But there's a lot of nudge-nudge winking, say no more going on by Benjamin Netanyahu. And that's the cover that the Europeans are going to use. The Americans have stayed silent on it as well. So the fingers all point to them. If the EU and the other major superpowers or the powers in the world continue to allow Israel to get away with this kind of behavior, then of course it doesn't bode well for the international peace this planet. And I think if everybody else started acting in the way this rogue entity does, we'll soon have World War III on our hands.
All right. Mohsen Abbas, political commentator. Mohsen, thank you for coming on. Moving on now. A last-ditch legal attempt to prevent a controversial UK Home Office deportation flight to Jamaica has failed. The case was brought forward by two siblings whose father was on the flight, arguing that the current deportation policy was unlawful because the Home Office had failed to properly assess the best interests of children whose parents were being deported. Permission to further assess the impact on children was denied before the flight, but the case is ongoing. In February, the government deported 17 British residents to Jamaica. The Home Office had planned to make 50 deportations, but the majority were stopped by a Court of Appeals injunction due to access to justice concerns. Well, let's cross over to our correspondent, Richard Sudan, who is outside the UK's Home Office for us. Richard, despite the petitions and the pressure, the government has broken its own equalities law and deported these individuals.
Well, I mean, shambolic, catastrophic, inhumane and racist is frankly how this latest, scandal, let's call it what it is basically being talked about by people. Now, of course, on the one hand, there's been a kind of temporary victory, you could say, of sorts, because we know that in the early hours of this morning, a number of people were pulled off the plane after last-minute reprieves, last-minute legal interventions. But, of course, this really begs the question, why did it take a mass public campaign? We saw a huge outpouring of support for calling for these deportations to be halted. Why did it take that and last-minute interventions from human rights lawyers to get us to this place? And of course, what mechanisms, what safeguards are going to be put in place to prevent this happening in the future? Of course, none of the recommendations from the previous Windrush scandal have actually been implemented, and now we're seeing the effects very much affect the wider Windrush family, if you like.
And Richard, not only has the government here not canceled these deportations, there was a lot of pressure also on, for Jamaica to accept these returnees. Is Britain throwing its weight around here?
Well, I do think that's how many, many people are interpreting this, Saeed. Of course, there have actually been many Caribbean nations who have voiced their concern, about this whole debacle, not just human rights lawyers, not just those nations, not just a massive petition that amassed hundreds of thousands of signatures. And again, in the face of all of the evidence, all of the recommendations, which have been basically ignored, the Home Office almost seemed kind of ideologically determined to push this flight through, were it not for the goodwill of human rights lawyers and activists who have very much been keeping an eye on this and making a lot of noise about it. The situation could have been much worse. But let's be clear, a number of deportations have happened. They have gone ahead. And again, this really begs the question, what's going to happen in the future?
And finally, Richard, let's talk about Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, who is continuing the hostile environment policy, something she's had to apologize for just recently. Where does this leave Britain's immigration policy, especially post-Brexit?
That's a very good question, Saeed. And I think, understandably, there are going to be a number of immigrant communities in the United Kingdom, not necessarily just black communities, but immigrants from all over the spectrum, particularly from within EU countries, who are going to be looking at this latest scandal and wondering if the Home Office can get this so dramatically, catastrophically wrong, having a devastating impact on families. What might be the implications for them if the Home Office also gets many of their statuses wrong in the future?
All right. Richard, it's very cold out there. Get yourself somewhere warm. Richard Sudan, outside the UK Home Office for us. Richard, thank you. Staying in Europe, the continent's high representative, Josep Borrell, has pledged to use all possible means to continue improving human rights in Bahrain. His statement came in response to a letter by MEPs highlighting the, quote, dire condition of human rights in Bahrain. The kingdom has the highest number of political prisoners in relation to population, and the British government is accused of colluding with the ruling regime by giving it technical assistance and training for its police force.
The last time the EU and Bahrain had dialogue was more than a year ago. The execution penalty, the right to just prosecution, arbitrary detention, torture and ill treatment were discussed. The High Representative has assured MEPs that the issue will be discussed again during the next human rights dialogue slated for the end of autumn 2021. That means another year for Bahrain's political prisoners, many of which are women and children. Human rights groups say arbitrary arrests and torture go on unabated, and if the West takes its eye off the situation for even a moment, many people could be executed without a fair trial.
Waiting until autumn 2021 to engage in talks with Bahrain is absurd, and Europe, although it's paid great lip service in recent years, needs to be much more proactive in the engagement for dialogue. In essence, Christmas has always been used as a time when they use it as a smokescreen to be more active in their persecution. We saw a few years ago that Sheikh Ali Salman was taken at that time.
Mohammad Ramadan and Hossein Ali Musa are two Bahraini pro-democracy activists who have been sentenced to death. They insist they, alongside many others, were tortured into falsely confessing to going against the ruling regime. Westminster is accused of being complicit in torture and suppression in Bahrain and allowing executions to go forward without intervening.
By any objective legal judgment, Mohammed Ramadan and Hossein Musa have not had due process. And why can't the FCO not put its mouth where British money is going and very vigorously obtain for these two men, at least now, a delay of execution and a fair trial?
With clearly documented failures of the SIU investigation into Mohammed and Hussein's torture, will the government now accept that its technical assistance to Bahrain has failed in its aims and objectives?
My Lord, the United Kingdom's technical assistance is kept under regular review and is provided in line with international standards, and let me assure the noble Lord, fully complies with our domestic and international human rights obligations.
That was July 8th of this year. On the 13th of July, Bahrain's highest court upheld their death sentences after the British government refused to intervene in their cases. Since the 2011 Arab uprisings, Bahrain's regime has used maximum force to quash dissent and silence calls for reform. Since 2012, Britain has provided £6.5 million of technical assistance to Bahrain, including training for Bahrain's Ombudsman prisons and its Special Investigations Unit, two institutions which failed to properly investigate the torture of Mr. Ramadan and Mr. Musa. Bianca Rahimi, London.
An update now on the German man suspected of killing at least five people and injuring several others by plowing his car into a pedestrian street in Trier on Tuesday. The city's chief prosecutor says the man was driving while intoxicated. Peter Fritzen told the news conference the 51-year-old suspect had consumed a significant amount of alcohol ahead of the crime and did not, as some had suspected, have any motives for political or religious terrorism. The UK has become the first country in the world to approve the Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccine, paving the way for future mass vaccinations for UK residents. Health Secretary Matt Hancock has said 800,000 doses of the jab, said to be 95% effective, would be available in the UK from next week. Top of the list of those to be immunized, care home residents and staff, followed by over 80s and health practitioners. Elsewhere in Europe, Italy's Minister of Health has announced his country would be launching a massive free coronavirus vaccination program early next year, with health workers and the elderly to be given priority. In France, President Emmanuel Macron has said the nation would be embarking on a broader COVID-19 vaccination program in the spring of 2021. This after a smaller vaccination campaign takes place in January of next year. Staying with the French president, he has declared his country will not agree to a Brexit trade deal if it does not meet France's long-term interests, particularly those to do with trade and fishing rights. The UK and France have been locked in a bitter battle over post-Brexit fishing rights. The French president aims to maintain EU access to British waters, a demand the UK government is fiercely against. Macron's comments come as Belgian Prime Minister Alexander De Croo said the European Union and Britain were in the last minutes of a football game, quote-unquote, when it came to discussions over Brexit. Britain will officially leave the EU on December 31st. Two stories in this segment. Story one. A few days ago, Israeli soldiers shot and killed a 36-year-old Palestinian man at a checkpoint in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. The soldiers who did it claimed Nur Shagher, attempted to carry out a car ramming attack. Today, their story unraveled. And Robert Inlakesh joins me now with an update. Robert?
Well, this execution, which took place over a week ago now, has been documented by B'Tselem, which is an Israeli human rights organization, to have been a car ramming that never was. They go through the report. This is a leading human rights organization in the area. Israeli guards from private companies and also Israeli border police pursuing a Palestinian after he had entered a checkpoint in East Jerusalem with what they said was false documents. He tried to flee the scene after he was approached by gunmen. He hit one of them. And then he parked his car up here where you just saw them approaching. And on the way, they were firing multiple rounds into his car. And he was killed by the shots which were fired when his car was parked in a position which posed absolutely no threat to Israeli soldiers. Netanyahu has not commented on this. And on top of that as well, the Israelis have even given the body back of Nur to his family.
Is that an admission of guilt, Robert?
Absolutely, because for any people that know what happens in Palestine is that if the Israelis do suspect somebody committed an attack, they condemn them as a terrorist and they keep the bodies of suspected terrorists. They gave the bodies straight back, and they also did not release the video footage from the checkpoint, which is readily available for them to do so, and if they were right, would prove they are in the right. On top of this, we have seen no prosecution of those who pursued and shot him illegally. Extrajudicial execution. There was no reason to execute him. B'Tselem has outlined this. Others have commented on this. And at this time as well, it seems absolutely a possibility that Israel, the military, was disagreeing with the police and that this is a huge cover-up.
An extrajudicial execution, as you say. What has the online reaction been to this story, Robert?
The first we've got here says, just another murder by the IDF thugs that will go unpunished by the criminal state of Israel. The UNHRC will remain silent. And then we have another one here as well that says, imagine if international law were actually humanitarian and the media would pursue all those who are hostile to the Palestinian people and accuse them of being anti-Palestinian.
All right, let's go straight to your second story, Robert. The recent death of the British founder of the White Helmets, the unfolding cover-up at the OPCW, the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons, of an apparently staged chemical weapons incident in the city of Douma, and how some in the mainstream media are trying to whitewash it.
Well, this story focuses in on the specific series called Mayday, which was just released as a podcast series by BBC. I'd actually been listening to it today. And what it attempts to do is to say that a number of activists, journalists, and experts as well were all part of conjuring up crazy anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. They claim that they are anti-Semitic. They focus heavily in on Vanessa Beeley specifically in this series, the woman who put it together for the BBC. Seems like she has a personal vendetta against Vanessa because Vanessa refused to be featured on the program. When you listen to the program, they don't present any real counterpoints to any of the points made, such as that James Lemessurier was perhaps involved in, or his organization, the White Helmets, was involved in organ trafficking, its massive funding from Western intelligence agencies, and the fact that it is a front for multiple militant groups operating in the Takfiri areas held of Syria. So the series in of itself is trying to present anyone that presents or believes in an alternate theory of what's been going on in the war, that the war was conjured up by Western governments in order to take out the secular government of Syria and replace it with Takfiri militant-led states, or what they would attempt to call caliphates. And if you believe that the West was involved in this, even though the footprints are there, which they even note inside of the series, then you're a crazy conspiracy theorist who should be shunned by the world.
And Robert, the truth will out, as they say, and we should hope it will. How has social media reacted to this story?
The first one here we have commenting on this article, which was published in the Gray Zone. They say Aaron Mate, who was